To level up your Tetris pieces so they can shoot bombs. This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Asher Vollmer. Asher is the developer behind the wonderful iOS puzzle games, Puzzle Juice and Threes, is now working on his upcoming game, Close Castles. Hi, Asher.
Hey there.
Good to have you on the show. We're very excited to be having you today because we're going to be talking about 2D puzzle games, the possibly longest-running portable game genre, going all the way back to Tetris and to today. There's never been more interesting, fun, and cool 2D puzzle games. And having made my most recent puzzle game addiction being Threes, I was excited to meet you at XOXO last week. And I wanted to kick things off by asking you a super broad version of the question that we're going to dig in today. What makes a good 2D puzzle game in your high level?
That is an excellent question because I know a lot of people who try to make interesting 2D puzzle games and just fail miserably, and I feel really bad for them. I've been thinking about this problem because I want to help people make better games. And I think usually it comes down to, there's a lot of nuance here, but usually it comes down to, does your very simple verb, because the verb has to be simple, does your very simple verb have lots of repercussions? And I think if that's true, then you're going to have an interesting game.
So the verb being like combining letters or whatever, like the core game loop of the thing that you do to the world.
Exactly. If your verb is like slide or tap or, you know, like press this specific part of the screen, you know, it should affect things, not just like your main verb. Like, let's say it's, you know, delete the gems. It like in Bejeweled is a good example. Your main verb is swapping. And that not only matches gems and gets rid of them, it also moves another piece into a place that you might like. And also new pieces fall from the top in whatever shape that was match three. On the board. And so all of these different things happen. And then basically the interesting part, like the addiction, the fun, like how do I keep getting better at this feeling comes from how do I master all of these different verbs all happening at the same time?
So a small action has a big reaction.
Exactly. And I think that's like the core of making it interesting. And there's a lot of ways to go wrong with that also. There's a lot of like making things too complicated or too obtuse or too, I've seen this pattern where it feels too, they're trying to, steal too much from other games. And then it just becomes like, to someone who's not familiar with games, it just becomes totally obtuse. You know, it's like, this gives you armor and that has, armored, damage reduction, which does this. And then you have to also master D&D in order to master this game, which is not
to level up your Tetris pieces.
Exactly.
So they can shoot bombs at your, yeah. And so just as a kind of games that we've already mentioned, so might as well use them as examples, obviously relevant. For those who haven't played Puzzle Juice, it was at least the first game of yours that I've seen, which is an iOS puzzle game. Kind of has a Tetris-y meets word game, and there's like multiple different pieces, types of gameplay and power-ups and stuff. Whereas Threes, which probably most folks have played, because we mentioned it a lot before on the show, but has a substantially smaller number of mechanics, or at least it feels that way. Is that something you feel like is a progression over time, or just two different styles of games that you took on?
They are two different styles of games, but in my opinion, I feel like I've become a better game designer in the space between Puzzle Juice and Threes. Puzzle Juice, I added more and more verbs as a way to like increase the complexity and the depth of the game. I just because not only do you play Tetris, but you also spell words and you also do color matching. And I managed to like work that into the theme of the game, which is that there's just too much stuff going on. And it's like the feeling of being overwhelmed. And I was like, well, that worked out.
I love in the trailer when you're showing different things happening, there's a self-awareness of, you know, you're putting down Treacherous Pieces in color matching and then suddenly things explode and it's like, whoa, that happened. Okay. And that's like in the narration of the trailer, which
exactly
makes it kind of fun.
Right. Because that's like the thoughts that are going through a player's mind. So it's like, yeah. So we wanted to embrace that. Like I think like that's another part of game design that should be like a lot of attention should be brought to, which is how you sell the game should reflect how people will play the game. That's like a whole nother topic.
I definitely encountered that. I hadn't played Puzzle Juice before, and Alan was just asking me about it, I think, before the show. And so I watched the trailer, and it was just like complete sensory overload of I don't understand what's happening here. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where knowing that, like, I'm sure I could grab the game and play it, mm-hmm. but if I was just coming into it with like, oh, hey, the guy who made Threes made this, like, maybe I should give it a shot because I like Threes so much. I think you'd be a little weirded out by it because it's such a different style of game, right?
Yeah, totally. And it has so much, like, it's all about being overwhelmed. So we just try to communicate that, like, in like the copy. Like, there's the only difficulties are hard, Euro mode extreme, and impossible. Those are the only like three difficulties. There's no easy mode or anything. So we have to like, we're just constantly pushing at the player, like, this is gonna be a lot. Be prepared to take in a lot. And that sort of, that actually kind of worked out because it actually isn't that hard, but it has the appearance of being that hard. So you just have to, you basically have to go with players' expectations and be like, they expect this to be hard, so we're just gonna tell them it is, even though it's not actually like that difficult, which is fun. I really like doing that, just agreeing with people or like telling people a fact about something I'm working on, which might not like strictly be true, but then they internalize it so much that it becomes true. I don't know, like there's a good example of this. I'm a big fan of, this is totally tangential. I'm a big fan of YouTube videos and YouTube communities and vloggers. And there's this one specific vlog community that they keep saying their community is the best community of all time and very positive and loving and just amazing. And that was never like completely true. Like they've always had trolls and people lurking in the shadows and all that stuff. But because they've been saving the same narrative for years and years and years and years, that the community has actually become warm and loving and positive. And that the trolls are basically totally almost suffocated out completely.
Just like a consensual delusion.
Exactly. And I think that's like a totally valid way to advertise and talk about your own games and your projects and all that stuff.
Well, creating that sense of like being on the edge of being overwhelmed can be a very conscious, you know, anytime you're making a game, you have to think about how do I want the player to feel when they're playing this. And another game that comes to mind, which is not exactly a puzzle game, but Crypt of the Necrodancer has that feeling if you've played that, where because you have to move on every beat, you have this much more sense of kind of urgency of being, your brain can just barely, I mean, just like any other rhythm game, you can barely kind of keep up because it's always moving.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of my absolute favorite 2D puzzle games of all time, Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, which has exactly that, like, just everything is completely overwhelming all the time, and being just about to win looks exactly like being just about to lose, mm-hmm. and you never know which one you are until it happens, and there's just crazy stuff going on all the time.
So with Puzzle Juice, you are looking to kind of get that feeling, or maybe that's how it just sort of came about as you were building it. What was there a particular feeling you're going after when you were working on Threes, or did that sort of evolve as it came together?
I mean, Threes evolved as it come together. Like, I think, I mean, I'm a big advocate that the game design always comes first and that you focus on that, and make sure that the core gameplay is the best before you really work on the other stuff, the marketing and how you're going to sell it and how, and all that stuff. So I focused on making it a simple game, a tiny game, because I didn't want to spend that much time on it. that was like one of my goals. Like, I want to do this pretty quickly.
Yeah, so how long did you think you would spend on it when you started?
Oh, I was like, oh, this is 6 months easy. And it ended up being a year in development before we released it. And now I've just been supporting it ever since. And we released it, you know, 9 months ago or something. So it's much taken on a much bigger, it's much bigger than I expected. But we were like, this is a small game and we're going to make it small and everything about it should be small. So it's just a small grid. It never grows. Like that was my big thing. I was like, I never want the grid to grow and I never want power-ups to show up because those are definitely crutches. Those totally are ways that I would artificially add content instead of like having the game be intrinsically interesting forever. I would just be like adding power-ups and levels, and that was not something I wanted to do. So I was like, this is going to be small and tiny, and when I realized that, we're like, we're going to have to manage people's expectations so that they're not expecting a giant game. We're not going to tell people like, this is a game that will keep growing and you'll level up and you'll get new characters and all that stuff. It's just, and so we were like, this is a tiny game. But then we realized that the game was strong enough where you could just keep playing it over and over and over again every day for like, we were playing it for a year and we were still enjoying it. So we ended up throwing marketing pitches around like, Threes is a tiny game that you can play forever, is still my favorite phrase. Though we ended up with Threes is a tiny game that grows on you, because it's a little more vague and punny and like a little more intriguing.
Well, the grows on you feels right with the sort of just kind of tone and style, I think, of the characters and the music and stuff like that. Like
exactly.
You like get this warm fuzzy as you are
like
getting into it.
Like give it a chance. I think that's a big, basically, I feel like in terms of like what makes a game successful, there's the two parts of it. There's, how do you get people to pick up your game the first time? And how do you get people to just keep playing your game? And I think you really have to succeed at both of those things if a game's going to take off.
So the side of it of keep getting people to keep playing it once they have, you know, picked it up and started playing it seems to be this sort of depth gameplay thing, the impossible to master half of the simple to learn but impossible to master quote about chess, right? Did you understand early on with Threes that, like you mentioned that you kind of made that epiphany at some point so that you could keep playing and that it had that deep gameplay. How far was that into the sequence?
Well, it took me a while to get to the point where like I was confident. Like I was not confident about the game for a long time. But the thing that kicked me over the edge was just the very first prototype. I made it like over a night from the hours of like 10 p.m. to like 5 in the morning. I just like worked all night and I made the first prototype. And then that morning I sent it off to friends like over Facebook and over email. And then I would get messages back from them an hour later and they'd be like, oh, I've been playing this game for an hour. But I get it. I'm done. Thanks for sending me this prototype. It's kind of weird. And I was like, wow, if in one night I can make a game that people will play for an hour, that's kind of promising. I was like, this seems like a good idea. Because usually if you work on a game for, you know, 9 hours, people will play it for 2 minutes and be like, okay, that's cool, I get it, and then move on with their lives. But I had this strong foundation of like, here's a weird mechanic, which is sliding numbers on a grid. How can I keep modifying it to make it so that it doesn't become boring and there's always more to do? And that process took a year.
Yeah. What were the main things that were sort of missing from that original prototype that you think put it over the edge that way?
Well, definitely, there was no number. So the mechanic I started with, I was like, I just want to put numbers on a grid and work with the four directions. And the number I started with were 1, 2, and 3. And the simple rule is that ones would only combine with twos. And then threes, you could combine, multiples of threes, you could combine however much you want. So you do 3, 3, 3, and 3 to make 6, or 3 and 6 to make 9. And so you could just match whatever multiples of 3 together. And so eventually, once you figured out how to manage the ones and twos, which took about an hour, you could just survive forever because all your threes are just bunched together. And actually, I was stuck on that for probably, you know, I worked on it for 3 months and then I took a 3 month break. And then only after that 3 month break and I came back, and I like started playing around, I was like, oh, what if they had to match?
That's funny, because that's like the core of the, if people were to describe the game in one like very, very, very small byte, it would be you combine matching numbers. And then there would be like, oh, and then there's this little thing about this, the ones and twos that you combine.
No, totally.
To make threes.
No, everyone was like, so you start with the matching, right? Everyone assumes that, which I love, because that took 6 months to get to. But it's like super elegant.
It's also interesting because the majority of the clones of threes that, you know, that ended up getting a bunch of press sort of because there were so many open source versions of it. And because of the sort of controversy of like, are they ripping off game design from threes and stuff like that? For me, the big failing of all of them is that they've only got the matching gameplay. Like what makes the gameplay of threes deeper is one and two make three. And so you always have this pressure of considering the management of those tiles on the edge of your board. Whereas I find that like 2048 and all the various clones of it are actually way more mechanical and simple and don't feel like they have any strategy to them than threes does.
Mm-hmm. No, actually I'm totally gonna agree with you. I like, so that the stance that I've taken on 2048 is that it's a good primer for threes. It's like if you're into that, then you'll probably enjoy threes also. And so go check it out. It's a little more advanced and you'll hold your attention a little longer because of the because of the ones and two component, like because it's mixing and matching. But also, like, my least favorite part of 2048 is how when you make a move, all the numbers slide all the way to the side. And I find that like totally maddening and sloppy. Because like I said, like the games are interesting if you put more repercussions to every verb. So if it takes four steps to move across the board and every step a new tile spawns in, you have a lot more to deal with all at once. And I think there's room for a lot more nuance there. So instead of like, I have to get this across the board, but I'm also going to deal with these things along the way, there's much more ways to screw up and also ways to be clever. And I think that's really my least favorite part of 2048.
So we could probably dig deep into the whole world of all the various clones and their failings, but I'm sure you're probably bored of talking about that by now in the scheme of, you know, other podcasts and things like that.
Oh, yeah. It's the number one question everyone asks me nonstop.
What do you think about all that? Okay, yeah. So we can, not only can we imagine what you think, we can find it on the various podcasts. And if anyone has not seen, there's an interesting thing you posted of many of the emails that went back and forth, which you've posted. I'll put a link on your site of various game designs and the sort of history of building threes, which I think is sort of a more interesting thing that came out of that, you know, clone issue, because you might not have put in the effort to kind of show the work of all the history that went into all these. And when you have a final game, you know, for any, especially puzzle games, because puzzle games often have complex gameplay that comes out of something simple, it can feel sort of, Nigel is the term of Nigel's, that it can feel like a found object. Like once you, it's like discovering something of physics as opposed to creating, you know, gravity, right? And once you see it, you're like, oh, well, of course, it makes sense once you see it. But the getting there is harder than it looks. And going through, even just on the, like, let alone the gameplay mechanics, like you can see arrows and holes and things like that, and like things that had kind of been in the game and that you were able to actually kind of like simplify out of the game, and it ended up becoming richer for it. But even just looking at like the gameplay, or sorry, the visual style for some of the things, there's like an Argyle style at one point. There's like, it goes through a neon thing. There's a thing where like, at one point there was food, like monster cards and food cards, and the monsters would eat the food and stuff like that. I just thought it was like super, and there's atomic, which actually makes a lot of sense, right? Like, yeah, atoms combine and stuff like that. Was the constant re-theming and exploring different themes, do you think that was like a fun, you know, process, or was it like always feeling like, oh, this, we're just, it still isn't right. We keep have to changing it.
Definitely the second one. So that definitely, we were struggling because it never felt right, because we knew that there was this core quality that we all enjoyed and wanted to jump onto, but figuring out how to best express it was so difficult and mind-numbing and like exhausting. And it took a, and by the time like we were using all these Greg's different faces, like his Argyle faces and his monsters and his food and all this stuff. And we were stuck with those for, you know, 90% of development. And then in that last 10%, we're like, he makes the little faces at the bottom of the tiles. And I'm like, oh, that's good. Let's do that. Let's release this game.
Please, can we release it?
Please, we've been working on this too long. That's it. And it was like an act of, it wasn't desperation, but it was like, because we were both perfectionists and we, you know, tweaked it and iterated on that still. But it was so relieving to finally see like what it could look like and that we would both like and be happy with. And yeah, and you mentioned all the holes and the arrows and stuff, and that was all part of that. I'm glad we did those. I'm glad we tried all that stuff and adding power-ups, and because it gave me the confidence to know that those are not supposed to be in this game. Because after putting in a power-up and then playing the game, I'm like, oh, this game just wants to be simpler. This game doesn't want all this layers of meta games on top of it and power-ups and all that stuff. It just wants to be simple numbers moving around a grid. So, and I wouldn't know that, and I couldn't say that with such confidence unless I already tried it. So those months felt, I think, were very necessary, but also very painful.
So in the context of how, you know, what goes into making a great puzzle game, did you feel like you learned any more efficient ways of culling through the problem space of different ways it could be, having been through it a couple times? Or do you feel like if you want to make a great puzzle game, you have to spend a year and a half trying 8 different styles and trying a whole bunch of mechanics, and it's kind of just a trial and error wandering mm-hmm. through the desert with talented people?
I mean that's definitely one way to do it, and it's what we did, and I think we could do it again. But I like to think that I've learned from this, and basically that taking away is always better than adding, and adding should always be your last resort. And when you're designing a game, you often reach these points and you look at the game, you're like, oh, this is the problem. People are doing this and not having fun here. Like in threes, we were like, this game in threes, the problem for a long time was this game stops being interesting after an hour. What do we do? And so we tried putting band-aids on it and adding crutches, like the power-ups, or adding a monster that runs around the field and this weird gambling mechanic. And we threw all that in because we were trying to address, trying to put a band-aid on the problem of it getting boring, when instead we should have stepped back and looked at the core game design and been like, oh, the problem is that it's boring intrinsically, and we should fix that instead of trying to patch it up. And so I think when you're adding stuff, you fall into that trap of trying to address the symptoms instead of the causes.
It's easy for the first hour to be fun. You know, making a prototype in one night that's fun for an hour is awesome, but novelty will power you through the beginning of something someone haven't seen before, but will not power through hours, you know, 4 or hour 20, or, you know, of the game.
Exactly.
So what was it was there any particular epiphanies to, once you were able to cut that stuff out, to keep it, you know, entertaining beyond that hour, beyond the sort of visual style of the characters eating each other and things like that?
I mean, beyond that, we were intent on making a minimalist game, so we didn't want to add anything. The only driving force we wanted was like the simple pleasure of beating your old score and unlocking new faces as you go, which is just inherent to the game. As you play the game, you're going to get higher numbers. And so we were intent on keeping that. We didn't even, you know, like, I think we could have, and I think we could have gotten away with having like it pull out your friend's scores from Game Center and then showing you the friend's scores and be like, hey, you're only 100 points away from beating your friend. But we didn't do that. And I'm glad we didn't, because it meant that people would just talk to each other more. Like, if people were interested in how their friends are doing, they would actually just reach out to their friends and ask.
Well, they would tweet the highest pieces they've got and their highest scores, which is how I originally saw it, was a whole bunch of my friends tweeting these high numbers in some game that I'd never heard of.
Oh, yeah, there's a tweet button in the game, and it's easily, like, I am super proud of that button. Because a fun side effect, this was no way intended, but it just totally worked in our favor and was totally accidental, is that in the because we didn't have any trophies or medals or like, congratulations, you beat this artificial score ceiling that we put in the game so that we could encourage you to keep playing, which a lot of games do. Instead of that, we didn't put in any context for how well you're doing. We have like no, we don't say what's a good score or what's a bad score. We just let you play and then people get, you know, 500 points. They're like, that's really good. That's a really high number. And little do they know that like the most talented person in the world, you know, gets like 800,000 points. But they don't know that. And also to figure out like if they're really like craving context, they'll reach out to their friends or they'll tweet their score and be like, is this a good score? And I really like that. Basically, I push people into social situations to get the context instead of putting it all in the game.
Yeah, I hadn't until you just now mentioned it. It hadn't occurred to me that because the gameplay, as you combine numbers and you occasionally will achieve a new level of, you know, working with a higher tile than you'd seen before, because the character design actually ends up being the reward in mm-hmm. that you get to see a new character with, you know, little expressions or noises and stuff that they make. That actually is the reward that, you know, in some places other games would have a more explicit reward, like you got this such and such trophy. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, like, you know, the reward is the piece that like has like a weird elegance that the piece needed to be there anyway. In the original prototype, it was there, except now it's like, ta-da, you unlocked 120 or 96 or whatever. And that's fun. I like that, actually.
It also, I think, gives you a better, like a more concrete milestone than a specific score. Like, I couldn't tell you what the best score I've ever got off the top of my head is, but I know that, like, you know, the 1500-ish piece, I don't remember what the exact number is, but, you know, the one you get from merging
two
768s is the biggest one I've seen. Like, past that, but I don't remember, you know, I think maybe it was 20,000 and some points that I got out of that, but I couldn't tell you what the exact score is, but that gives you a nice milestone of, you know, yeah, that piece is the best I've done.
So, expanding a little bit on the sort of general aesthetic of these games into a more general sense, there's this particular style. I mean, obviously, indie games will attract towards certain styles that are achievable by a small team. So we see the rise of 8-bit, and you know, there's more 8-bit games than you could ever play nowadays. But one style that I've been noticing recently in recent years is this sort of whimsical minimalism. I'm not sure if that's the best way to describe it, but that's just kind of like the way I describe a game, like Threes or Letterpress or Bleck is another game, if people have seen that one, where you like draw something on the screen and it will sort of repeat across the screen and you have to try to solve puzzles with that. Have you noticed that trend, and what do you think about it?
I mean, I've totally noticed it because it's also, you know, iOS 7, you know, sort of pushed that into the public consciousness. Like, hey, everything's flat now. Everything's like going to be flat and pretty and colorful and bright colors. And I couldn't be happier because I love flat, bright colors. But I think the easiest explanation, like, is that it's cheap. It's very inexpensive for one person with a good eye to put some flat colors in the right place and be like, yes, this looks good. And have that, and have lots and lots and lots of people all over the world agree, yes, that does look good, without having to hire, you know, an artist to do like these complicated creatures, or having to go out and take a picture of a piece of wood and then get that texture and then apply it to like the desktop that you're trying to emulate on the phone, you know, all this stuff. It's super cheap and it's easy and it's pleasing, and I'm sure we're going to get tired of it. And then something's going to come out that like looks very real to life, and we're going to like be super happy because it looks different and exciting. But currently it's like a super cost-effective way to get your ideas across. And, you know, we're in the golden age of minimalist games.
It's kind of great.
Yeah. I mean, I love it because I don't want to hire lots of people because I'm worried that I won't be able to support them forever. So I like being able to do this stuff myself or with one other person.
There's definitely also a certain honesty to having that kind of minimalist design, in that it's being you know, intentionally bringing the mechanics to the forefront rather than trying to come up with some metaphor of, you know, here's a realistic looking thing, but it behaves in some way that's dictated by the game design. You know, you have that problem a lot with big realistic looking games, is that sometimes you get a bit of an uncanny valley effect of like, yeah, you're walking through this huge city in this first person shooter, but actually you can't go down any of these side streets because we didn't build those. And so there's just going to be walls everywhere. And, mm-hmm. you know, it makes those mechanics more often more obvious. Whereas in a game that's intentionally minimalist, you get this nice effect of just being able to say like, here's a concrete representation of the mechanics elements that you're moving around, and we'll just show you what they mean, and then you just operate on those without having to have some metaphor to some real world object in, you know, in between things.
Oh, that's a really good point. I really like that.
Yeah, and there's entire mechanics that just would never have, like, a Threes game where you had fully like painted or three-dimensional monsters eating and combining and talking, but sitting in these slots that you could move around. Like, why? What's moving them? Are they walking around in grids? Like, it just you would, if you were in a world where only games that had a fully 3D realistic lit, like, you know, art style would do well in your market, then you probably wouldn't be able to make the gameplay in a way that felt sensible.
No, you're totally right. I mean, and don't think it didn't cross our minds. Don't think we were like, well, this should really be like, what if instead of ones and twos, it was a white bear and a black bear, and then they turn into pandas. And then this game's about pandas, and we need like to get a good artist who can do cute pandas. And I was like, no. But that ended up being terrible. And, you know, minimalism rose to the top. But you have to be careful, because it's also, we're seeing a lot of like very attractive minimalist games show up, and it's great. But there's a lot of like, you know, you have to be careful to do it right, because it's still easy to be unattractive and minimal, or boring or uninspired, or, you know, not juicy. I've seen like games that like look really good in screenshots, and then I download them and I touch them and play with them, and it just feels like I'm, you know, like I'm touching a computer screen and not like I'm playing with a world. And so you have to be really careful to ride that line between like not going too minimalist. Like, for example, in Letterpress, when you pick up a tile, there's a little drop shadow behind it. And that's for clarity, but it also adds depth. And it also, like, you know, it's a little, I forget, what's the word for things that look like they're trying to be, for digital things that look like they're trying to be real things?
Skeuomorphic.
Skeuomorphic, yes. So there's just like a very subtle skeuomorphism, which is like totally fine and actually helps understand and helps things look better. And sort of walking that line and choosing carefully which elements are skeuomorphic and which are minimalist, like is an art. And I would like to thank Greg Woolwind, who is the artist on Threes, for being amazing, and also on Puzzle Juice.
Yeah, that's definitely something that is hard to call out. Like, I don't know, maybe that's more of, we should have Greg on the show and ask him, like, how do you tread that line? Because it, I've definitely seen lots of games. Like, there was a post a couple months ago when in the sort of iOS productivity app scene, there was a bit of a row. I don't know if it's even a row, but a round of everyone posting their woe is me blog posts for having apps that were not commercially viable or successful that they'd put a lot of hard work into. And some of them were really great looking apps. But then there was enough Me Too posts from people where you would see ones where they had obviously absorbed this sort of that minimal style and looking like iOS 7 is good, but they hadn't sort of absorbed that subtle detail that extra 10% of animations or whimsy, or you know, maybe that's not the right thing to call it, but whimsy is necessary in order to bring something like that to life. Otherwise, it's just
I think whimsy is appropriate, and I think I totally understand how people miss it or how they don't work on it, because you know they're pouring their hearts and souls into this app, and they want it to be financially successful, but they're also on a time limit because their funds aren't infinite, and they put up their scrum sheets and they're like, what are the most important features? Well, these are the core features and this is the core feature and this will help these users. And then we could make them stretch, I guess. Why would we do that? That's not very important. Forget that. That's going to go like at the bottom of our priority list, and then, you know, deadlines happen and then they never do them. So I can totally understand why that happens. But basically it's them not understanding what makes, like, not appreciating that having users like deeply enjoy using their apps as essential to having people use them, or else they'll walk away and be like, that was not fun for some reason. Or it didn't fit my flow. You know, like a bunch of like very weird mental reasons that people come up with, which come down to like, it just wasn't fun to use.
And that's something that's easier to get useful feedback when you're doing a productivity app, that someone's trying to accomplish something. But if what they're trying to accomplish is have fun, then most people are not going to be able to say exactly why, other than maybe like it was too hard if they were dying or something. But that might not even be why they weren't having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Bithell is a game developer who's worked on various things. But he had a blog post a couple of days ago about Thomas Was Alone, which is this 2D platformy thing where the characters are all just little rectangles in the entire game, which is this kind of ridiculous art style when you look at screenshots or you first play it. I was sort of struck like, really, this is the game? It's just like little triangle or little rectangles. But he gets a lot of people asking, because the game was quite successful, and people asking him like, oh, how did you know it was going to work? Or like, it was so trivial. Like, have you changed, has the landscape for games changed now that, you know, you don't need any, you know, visuals in the game in order to make it playable? But he kind of went through all of the interesting tricks that he did in that game in order to make a game just out of little rectangles moving around actually have a distinctive and interesting visual style. You know, including like when the character jumps, it stretches, right? It's just a rectangle, but it's not a static rectangle. It stretches the way that like a cartoon character did. And like he read books about how to like animate comics, and like how book, like he spent time as like a typographer and a layout guy. So like the whole thing goes on a grid, and all of the levels and stuff like that have like this certain color palette. Like, and the entire game out of all of these, all the various levels, there's a specific color palette chosen by a professional color palette designer, and all these sort of things that when you look at a screenshot, you would probably say, oh, well, it's too simple for anyone to enjoy it visually. Or they would almost say it has no design, but it actually just has like a very strong design in the very few things that are designed. Mm-hmm.
About. And a lot of it has to do with traversing the game. Like that game, I played Thomas Was Alone, and I was so in love with it. I absolutely cried during it because it was just very compelling. Like,
and this is a game where the character is rectangle.
Yeah, they're rectangle. I was like weeping, you know, like, and there was such good narrative connection, like, because there's a narrator talking about what you're doing, and he describes all the characters, which are, you know, different colored cubes. And then, you know, I would switch to one cube and then jump on another cube, and I'd be like, this is so sweet. Look, they're supporting each other in their relationship. And it was just two cubes being near each other, being different colors, being different shapes. And watching the palette of the world change over time, like, really, you know, conveyed how they were progressing forward and how, the environments were becoming more threatening as they went on through their training software and all that stuff. And it's just, I'm just a big believer in strong design, because it actually makes people feel things, because you can get such power. It basically distills people's emotions down to colors and shapes and patterns. And we're so good, like, humans are pattern recognition machines. And so when we see something change, it registers with us and we put it in our mind and we're like, this changed for a reason. And I think Thomas Was Alone is a great example of how powerful that those little things can be. And I'm glad he wrote that blog post.
Yeah, have you read, did you read that?
No, I haven't, but but I'm agreeing with it on principle.
Yeah, yeah, I'll link it up in the show notes. It's always interesting to me to see the design decisions that have gone into all the various things around us, because it's very easy, especially in games where you just get absorbed in having the game, playing the game, which is probably not surprising that I'm interested in that, because I started an entire podcast about that. So changing gears a little bit, difficulty. How do you make those trade-offs, or what sort of inputs go into making that trade-off of how hard should a puzzle game be, balancing making the player feel awesome versus making them feel accomplished?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess when I'm, I went to game design school at USC, and I was learning a lot and absorbing everything. But I remember reading a very specific blog post by Chris Hecker, who's making a game called Spy Party.
That's the one they play PAX and stuff. Where
there is one person who's a spy at a party, like trying to pretend they're an NPC, and then one person who's a sniper, like looking at the party and trying to figure out which one the spy is. And it's incredible. It's like it's such a clever idea, and he's taken this like super weird concept that doesn't seem like a game at all. Like it seems like bait, like barely a game. And he's gamifying the heck out of it and adding in all these little ways to excel at it and balancing the difficulty between these two very asymmetrical problems that people are doing. Like one's trying to blend and one's trying to pattern match and problem solve, and making it competitive. And I found the whole development of that super interesting because it's crazy, because it's just like an insane problem that he's taken on. And there's a reason that it's taken him, you know, 5 years to do it. But early on, he set out this principle for himself that I really liked. And it's basically he would always go depth first and accessibility later. So he would always just focus on making the game fun to people who are really good at it. And then later on, he'd figure out how to teach it and all that stuff. And so I basically, I do embrace that a lot in my games. I'm like, I'm just going to make this as fun as possible for me, the guy who's been playing it the longest, because I've made it. So by definition, I've been playing it longer than anyone else. So if it's fun for me, then the game is going to be fun for people who end up playing it way longer than I do when I eventually abandon it because I'm sick of it. So it's really like if I stop having fun with the game, I become disappointed. And that doesn't mean if I'm sick of it. It means if I no longer find the act of playing it and the puzzles that I'm solving inside of it interesting, then it's not good. And this obviously, so this, I realize now as I'm saying this, that this advice comes from a place where I am the only designer on a game and can make these sort of blanket statements about what is fun and what is not, and it's totally objective, and I don't know how to scale this up to a team size, and I think that's actually a super good question. But as a one person, I'm in a unique position to judge, like, is this a super fun game for me and just and only me? And then, but at the same time, there's this thing with minimalist games, which is that all your decisions have big repercussions throughout your entire game design. So if I make a design change that is super good for me, the super advanced player, I am not going to ignore how that's going to make new players feel. If I'm like, this game needs some to be more exciting, I'm not going to be like, well, if it was timed, I would like it way more because it'd be way more interesting and I could play it, like, you know, really fast and challenge myself how fast I could do it. But that would scare, that would like easily scare away every new player, like making it timed. And they would hate that. So I have to be very careful about balancing. How do I make it interesting for me? How do I make it not scary for new people? And then I do I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I'm having a trouble organizing. I have a lot of brain going on right now. There's a lot to think about here. Because it's a really good question. Because you can't ignore new players, but you also can't cater just to them, but you also have to cater to them because they're the ones who are going to be judging your game the most, is new players. So you have to balance all of these things, and it's actually a really hard question.
I see this struggle play out a lot with early access Steam games, which are often not puzzle games, but even if they were, probably you would see the same thing, in that the people who are actively giving feedback in the game are the people who are the world's biggest fans of it, possibly even bigger fans of it than the people making it, and they're going to be giving feedback on the hardest parts, on the most, the most advanced levels, and they're going to be asking for more features and more systems and more power-ups, and some of those things that kind of takes away from the any elegance of the original game design are going to excite them more if there's sort of additions to the complexity rather than simplifications where, actually, if we take out these three systems, we can replace it with one simpler system that you haven't mastered and therefore is going to make you angry.
Mm-hmm. But, no, that's great. And that's a really good point, which is why early access totally scares me.
There's also a problem, I think, with puzzle games in particularly that, you know, more, I don't want to say action games. This isn't exclusive to action games, but, you know, lots of games with complicated game designs and kind of real world sort of metaphors of you're moving through some space and you're shooting bad guys and stuff like that often have some relatively simple knobs that you can use for dialing things up and down, right? You can say, all right, we've built this level of a first person shooter and, you know, we got a dozen people to play it and all of them had trouble getting through it. They all died too much. Okay, well, you know, let's dial the health on the enemies down a little bit. Let's dial how much ammunition we give up a little bit. And you've got these kind of numerical knobs often built into the concept to tune difficulty. Whereas puzzle games, oftentimes there aren't things like that. There's no, you know, in a game like Threes, there isn't necessarily a thing you can say, well, if we increase this number by 20%, it's going to get 20% easier for people, right? Because so much of the gameplay is just kind of an outgrowth of this simple set of mechanics. And so they interact the way that they interact. And the only choice that you've got if you need to tune things is to add a mechanic or remove a mechanic. And that's a much bigger change than, oh, all the enemies have 20% less health than they did before, and that's how we're gonna tune the difficulty level. But, you know, on the bright side, then, when it works, it has this real feel of, you know, like Alan said before, you know, the found object of, like, here's just this perfectly polished little gem of design where all the pieces fit together and everything feels right, but you know, you never really know when you're starting out if this game design is going to gel into one of those.
No, that's totally right. And I think like action games is a good point of comparison because, like, for example, Halo, when Microsoft tests or when they used to test Halo, the Microsoft usability stuff for Halo is crazy because when they have playtesters sit down and play the game, they're recording every single second of it and every point of data, and they're just recording these big giant swaths of data that the designers can later on just scroll through and see, like you said, like, oh, like 20% of players are dying here, we should tune this adjustingly, like accordingly, and then send it out to 1,000 more playtesters and then see how they react and look at their spectrum and, like, and, you know, it's all heat maps and very foggy, wobbly float, like, into, like, wobbly sort of decimal points and percentages you have to adjust in order to make something feel good. And that's a much scarier problem to me than puzzle games. Because puzzle game, like, as far as I'm concerned, and puzzle games are just integers, and I'm much happier putting a number up, like increasing a number by one or decreasing it by one than like adjusting something by a small percentage.
Because you know for sure that 0.00743 is never exactly the right constant for ammo spawning.
Exactly.
It's wrong in one way or the other.
Yeah, it's wrong for one person or for another. But people can, basically if it's two, it's either two or one or three, people will like understand that and have to deal with that. And also, it's like a lot easier, like, so I think this goes back to our minimalist visual design thing, which is that it's way easier to convey these complicated complicated systems in minimalist design because you just have very clear symbols for all of them. You know, like, this is what a three looks like, this is what a one looks like. And so you can have, this goes back to, like, when I'm trying to figure out difficulty, I just make the game that's most fun for me, and it's probably going to be hard for new players. But I'm convinced that I can make it visually understandable. Like, people will look at this complicated thing I'm doing and be like, "Oh, I get it. That thing is smaller than that thing, so they absorb and they do this." And you know, visual messaging through minimalist design is just a really good, clean way to get complicated systems and make them and simplify them, like in terms of how our mental models will work about them.
Do you think that there's any interesting impact to puzzle games or games in general to difficulty as the sort of business models have been changing? Because like Threes and Puzzle Juice are both paid up front games. So someone's invested, I don't know if it was originally $3 or $2 when Threes first came out. But invest $3, they're not going to play it for 8 seconds and then be like, this is too hard, and immediately give up. Although it happens that 3 says a very fun and cool tutorial. So even if they hadn't paid it, they would still have go through that sort of ramp up. But do you think that there's any sort of evolutionary pressure on the difficulty or balance of those sort of games as, you know, games go to like free within app purchase and things like that? Or do you think that's kind of decoupled from the business model?
No, I mean, like, I don't believe anything's decoupled from anything. I think every part of a game is connected to every other part of the game. So the moment, like, I am so scared of free to play for that reason, because the moment that you start putting money in the game, like people's actual financial situations, which are different for every person that you've ever met, is in a different financial situation. And then suddenly you're incorporating that into your game design. And it's a lot scarier and weirder, and you can't really account for it unless you're doing crazy, you know, data collection and like deciding that, you know, people are buying more of these things on average because of this psychological reason, so we should put more of these in so we can increase our income.
The Candy Crush guys have at least an entire office building full of people just calculating how exactly to extract.
No, they totally do. And like, and that's, I don't know, that seems antithetical to game design, is making people, or like, you know, at best, it's a weird artistic movement to make people, you like, calculate their own personal funds to figure out how they'll perform in a video game. And at worst, it's manipulative and terrible. So I am super scared of the free-to-play model because I don't know how to solve it or what's acceptable or what's good. And
when you mention it, people's sort of economic backgrounds, different people have different amount of resources available. So if you're a kid whose allowance is $1 a week, and then this game that, you know, in order to be able to get past the third level, you have to pay a 99-cent in-app purchase, to them, that might be this sort of just giant mountain that they, you know, to overcome. Whereas to someone who has a huge amount of, you know, of extra cash, it's just like, oh yeah, whatever, I'll just blow through it, like, you know, it's no problem. And then they effectively beat the game because they buy the Ultra Sword for 99 cents and then...
Yeah, and that's another, like, I mean, I feel like games are moving away from this because we're getting smarter, but if you're like, the trade-off they used to do for in-app, like the model they used to have for in-app purchases that people like sort of agreed upon was that it's either time or money. Either you're going to spend time grinding on this game, or you can pay $1 and skip all that. But the fallacy there is that you should be skipping the game. And if that's what you should be doing, then you're probably making a terrible game because you have parts that should be skipped instead of making your entire game super fun. But I feel like we're moving away from that and more towards, like, I think Candy Crush actually has a pretty good model, despite it being super weird to me, of lives, where basically in Candy Crush, you're always paying money to keep playing. And I find that totally acceptable because it's like an old arcade cabinet where they're putting the value on the gameplay because the gameplay is inherently fun. And I think that's good, though obviously I'm conflicted about it.
Yeah, and I mean, the bringing up the arcade cabinets is interesting because that's a situation where I've always thought it kind of funny in some ways, the modern like dislike of in-app purchase and sort of those grindy kind of games, when that's where things started, right? That arcade cabinets were the dominant form of gaming for, you know, at least a few years to a decade, and they're, you know, they've got all those same problems that in-app purchases did, and the game designs got distorted in the same way that, you know, that you make games much harder when people have to pay to keep playing them. And for the first couple of rounds of the home console games, console games were a lot harder than they are now, in part because people were coming out of that like arcade design experience. And in some respects, the in-app purchase stuff is just a return to that model. You know, it's not that there haven't been those economic forces distorting gaming before. It's just those forces are always shifting and the pendulum's always swinging back and forth. That said, I personally like the like paid up front, the designs that model produces better than the designs that the arcade model produces. Like I don't like going back and playing old arcade games because I find their designs kind of frustrating now in the same way that I find the designs of some in-app purchase games frustrating. But it's an interesting parallel for sure.
I'm even more in that camp because for someone who plays games fairly regularly, I kind of like easy games because I like beating them and then feeling satisfied and then being able to put them down rather than spending 200 hours trying to make that one jump and then starting at the beginning of the game or whatever. And so that particular sort of style of game, or at least tuning of game, can't really exist in a arcade putting tokens in style. You can't have a game where you can just sit down and play for an hour and not die. Like the Journey would be an example, right? Like a Journey is not hard, but it's satisfying.
Journey would be a terrible coin-op game.
It would make very little money.
That would be amazing. That'd be a good art project. You pay 25 cents and you play all of Journey.
That would be a good art project. Make some sort of statement on the absurdity of the... let's just sort of completely jump off of the pretense that we're only talking about 2D puzzle games, because mm-hmm. We've been jumping around all sorts of other kind of adjacent interesting topics. Yeah. And I want to ask you, Asher, at least a little bit about Close Castles, or give people an opportunity to hear about what you're up to there, because I got a chance to play it at EXO last week. I wasn't aware of it, and then I got to play it, and it looks really cool.
Yay, thank you. Thanks for that. It's still very much in development, so I mean, all I have are my opinions of it right now, but it might all change. But currently, the reason I'm making a Close Castles, let me pitch it. Forgot about it.
Yeah. So what's the game?
Close Castles has a lot of intricate art design. I don't know. Anyway, Close Castles is a competitive kingdom builder, is one way to pitch it. It's a competitive tower defense is another way to pitch it. It's a minimalist RTS is another way to pitch it. And it's all of these things. And basically, I'm making it because I wanted to make a game that was not like Threes. Because if I tried jumping into the 2D puzzle world again, I think people's expectations are crazy. And I don't want to even touch people's expectations about the kinds of games that I can make. And like I don't want to get into the topic of like, can I make Threes again? Because I don't know, and I don't care. I wanted to make something weird and competitive and fun to play at festivals, but still with my sort of very minimalist design sense. And basically, Close Castles on a grid, and it's between two players or four players, and all you do is build things. You either build a house to attack, a tower to defend, or a mine to increase your economy. So I've sort of boiled down the RTS genre into three buttons that I can fit onto a controller. And it's weird, but it's using those same principles I talked about earlier, where basically every verb you have has lots and lots of repercussions. The kind of buildings you build and where you place them on the map and their vicinity to enemies, people walking around the map, and all this stuff all has a lot of implications about how well you're going to do in the game. And yeah, it's sort of weird and new and still very much in, like, you know, its fetal stage.
So you describe it, calling it a competitive kingdom builder is kind of fun now that I know what, having played it, but I think it would give a sense of it being much more like a classical RTS or even like big strategy game. The grid, for anyone who has not seen the game, is like 8x8.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
The castles are very close to each other, and you play like, I played at a festival standing up, but I imagine it like sitting on a couch and playing it in your living room, and everyone can see everyone else. The grid doesn't scroll around, and so it's like fun and frenetic, and you'd play multiple rounds and things like that. And so it's interesting to me because I really love couch co-op type games, being able to play together in person, and there are not as many games being made in that genre as there used to be. You know, GoldenEye and the golden era of couch co-op or couch versus. I guess I call it couch co-op, but it's versus as well as co-op. You can play on teams of two or one versus one, things like that.
Yeah, actually, I'm a big fan of that genre too. So, which is exactly why I made it, there's this whole thing when you're making a game, you have to pick your audience. Like, if you don't know who your audience is, you're just going to sort of fumble around and not know why you're not selling your game and all this stuff. So my audience was couch multiplayer, and it's totally different than 2D puzzle on phone. So it means I can make the game a little more hardcore, a little weirder, and I can use people explaining the games to each other on the couch as sort of a way to add in more complexity, where they'll be like, oh, now I understand that this thing happens. And then they'll tell their friends who are right next to them that that's why that happens. And then information will spread that way. So it's actually a lot easier to design, and I can make a lot, you know, more complex systems in that environment, which I'm super happy with.
Yeah, I'm excited to see its progress. I guess I think you called it the fetal stage.
Yeah, it's still in the fetal stage. It's barely a game, in my opinion, though, you know, people seem to enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it's perfect for like festival. Like, if I played it for 2 hours, I might have been like, well, yeah, here's the problems with it. Yeah. But, you know, I played for 5 or 10 minutes. I'm like, this is great.
It's good. I'm just giving everyone a taste right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. So before we go, do you have any last nuggets of wisdom about designing great puzzle games?
The nugget of wisdom I have is, if you build a good tutorial, people will play your game.
I like that. Done. That's a good nugget of wisdom.
Done. Did it. Wisdomed.
All right. So wisdomed. Where can people find more about what you are up to, Asher?
The most up-to-date you can be about me is on my Twitter at twitter.com/AsherVo. And I also have a blog that I rarely update at AsherV.com.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We always want to know what you think. So please give us some feedback. You can find us at upup.fm or on the iTunes store. And see you next week. Played any good games lately?
Have I played any good games lately? I got a Wii U. I've been playing Nintendo Land with my friends.
Oh, you're the one who bought a Wii U. I saw it on the charts. They had a...
Nintendo Land is remarkably fun for what it is.
I don't know this one. What is Nintendo Land?
Nintendo Land, they take all their Nintendo franchises and they make little mini games out of them that work on the Wii U pad and the Wii controllers.
Oh, this is the bundled, the one that you get, that came out like with the launch of the Wii U? Or is it a new?
No, it came out the launch, but it's really good and really fun. And like, I have non-gamer friends who I just hand over the Wii U to, and they're like usually intimidated by the pad, but then they get super into it and very competitive in like a fun couch competitive kind of way.
Were you playing a particular, or did you buy the Wii U for a particular game release? Was it for Mario Kart or Smash Brothers or something?
I got it for Mario Kart, but I haven't actually played that a lot because I don't know the right situation to play Mario Kart in. Because I don't want to play it by myself. All my friends have either played all the iterations of it or have no interest in it. So I don't know when I'm supposed to play Mario Kart.
I think you are supposed to play it with other people.
I think so, but I don't know who those people are.
Well, I'll come over and we'll play Mario Kart because I enjoy it, but I'm pretty bad. So
okay, cool. Come over.
One of the things, I think I've even said this before talking about Mario Kart, but one of the things that I quite liked about this iteration of Mario Kart is that you can like do the single player unlocking of stuff multiplayer. Like previous rounds, if you wanted to like get everything unlocked so that you could have multiplayer matches with everything, you needed to go and play single player for a huge amount of time to unlock everything. But in this one, you can actually play Grand Prix in multiplayer. And as long as, you know, one of the people playing wins, you'll unlock the various stuff, which made it much more palatable to unlock things. So I just played it with one of my kids who was really into it. And, you know, he wouldn't, I think, have been able to unlock everything by himself, particularly not initially. Like now he's kind of getting good enough that he probably could go back and unlock everything himself now. But, and then it was, you know, like a nice social thing. Whereas with the previous ones, I've had situations like with Mario Kart Wii where Sam, my son who I was playing it with, really wanted to unlock everything and couldn't do it. And so he'd like give me homework to like play the game after he'd gone to bed and try and get stuff unlocked, because you needed to play single player. And so if we were trying to unlock stuff, we couldn't really unlock it together.
Sorry, I just figured out I'm going to lure my friends over by saying, you should help me unlock these levels.
Yeah, that's good. Especially if they are pretty good at the game, and then, you know, you create a social thing out of it.
I'm in doing that.
I picked up after multiple people who'd been on the show, as well as people in real life, and also the folks on Idle Thumbs were all talking about Divinity Original Sin, which is not a game I'd even heard of, but it's like a kickstarted RPG.
Oh, I have opinions about that game.
Because I really love Baldur's Gate, and I have been missing sort of the RPG-ness from, you know, I don't know, I've tried a couple, Mass Effect hasn't been a Mass Effect game in a while, and there's various other, and so I was like, okay, I'll try this game, it seems like I should like it, and I'm not very far into it, but I'm not sold yet.
I don't like it, I hated it. Because I'm literally in the exact same space as you, where I love Baldur's Gate, and basically I wanted another Western RPG. Like, ideally, it's a Skyrim that's not made by Bethesda. That's my goal.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, like a Skyrim, but it's not horribly buggy. Exactly. And having
I want to play that.
Embarrassing
so
character
I sat
animations.
Down and played Divinity Original Sin with just that goal in mind, and then it has a terrible story, and, like, weird level design, and... You know, the combat's a little fun, but it doesn't make up for the fact that I can't get lost in this super boring world that they invented. And I'm really mad at
it. It is the most cliche RPG, not even being very far in the story, maybe it gets better, but the most cliche RPG story, like almost everything that happens, it's like, of course it happens. Like, you go to the inn and people try to join your party. And then at some point, for no good reason, we get warped to the end of time and a crazy imp is like, you are the heroes of time, yeah. And you must go. And like, of course we are. And it wouldn't be that bad if the story was lighter, but there's a lot of exposition. Like, people are talking at you a lot, and you find these books, and you have to read the book that was sitting on Zilman's table to figure out where you're supposed to go sometimes and stuff like that, which makes it harder to sort of just roll your eyes and be like, yeah, okay, it's a cliche RPG story. Let me, like, kill bad guys. I also suck, so I can't kill anyone.
Right.
Like, I lose half, like, not half, I lose, like, 90% of the battles that I get into, which makes me avoid battles, which makes me not level up, which...
Well, yeah, so I literally just downloaded, on my friend's recommendation, I downloaded The Witcher 2, and I have high hopes that this might be the Western RPG that I'm looking for. So I'm going to play...
So I'd always assumed, not really knowing much about it, that it was sort of like a horror themed, because it has the word witch in the title. Is that the case?
No, it's a totally Western RPG, like, you know, old-timey, you're in a fantasy world, run around fighting. It's just that you're a man-witch, and man-witches are called witchers.
Man-witch. So not a meat-filled thing in between two.
I mean, you are also that, but in addition to that, you're also a male witch.
Right. Okay. So we'll see how much I can stand. Do you have any other opinions about Divinity? It seemed pretty one-sided.
I mean, I was like, oh my god! Like, and the level design is terrible because you can't rotate the camera, and they have you running towards the camera a lot, and then you can't see what's ahead of you, and that, like, bugged me so much because their game is isometric, and they should design it as such.
You can rotate the camera like one quarter,
exactly.
Which is weird. So how far did you get? I'll make sure that, because if you're way further than me, then...
I actually didn't get that far. I have very little patience for games I don't like. So I got to, like, I got to some docks, and there was a boat on fire, and then I tried putting it out, and then they got mad at me when I cast a water spell near them, and then everyone tried to kill me. I was like, I'm out. Forget this.
Okay, so I'm about four times further than that, and I've been playing for like 2 hours. So so you did not play very far. I'll play a little further and report back, but mostly due to the sort of post-mortem trying to understand thing rather than the... I'd be curious about The Witcher. I've heard some positive things about that. So Nigel had an interesting theory about the economics of those sort of classic RPGs, how so many of them used to be... sort of centered at, or at least relatively well supported by the sort of young teenagers playing Final Fantasy and Baldur's Gate and stuff like that. Economics that is when, you know, that's what I was when I was first playing those games. But that market has moved much more to, well, honestly, probably just Minecraft, like all Minecraft all the time.
Yeah, you're right.
So we're now, you know, those of us who wants to play a game like Baldur's Gate is just a bunch of sort of adult, nostalgic adults rather than necessarily a broad swath of the gamer population.
And like I was saying when we were talking about that, I think even for the nostalgic adults, the fact that RPG mechanics have crept into so many other genres peels off a certain percentage of them as well, right? Like if you couldn't get a game like, you know, like Dishonored or something like that, where you've got significant character customization in kind of a first person game, maybe I'd still be playing more RPGs, but that kind of stuff gives me enough of a fix, you know, your Dishonoreds or Deus Exes or whatever. That's enough of a hit for me that I don't need to go and play RPGs to get the nostalgia anymore.
It's kind of table stakes now for pretty much any AAA game. Maybe not any, but a very large percentage of AAA games now, you know, Destiny has it too, I believe, has these RPG elements. They definitely have like the equipment, but I assume that they also have sort of character stats to some degree.
I'm actually having trouble thinking of one that doesn't have RPG elements at this point.
I was as well, because I was going to say, well, yeah, unless it's a sports game, but like sports games, no,
they
are
have
like the modern RPG.
They absolutely have it too. Like it's just in everything, because the sense of progression, it feels good. It feels good to progress.
I think there's a few of the like huge shooters that don't. Like I wouldn't really say that Call of Duty has much in the way of character customization in the single player game, though I think there's more in the multiplayer games for those, but that's kind of a separate, a separate thing. Certainly you don't gain levels when you're going through Call of Duty.
What about Uncharted?
Oh yeah. Uncharted's a good.
I think Uncharted doesn't.
Yeah, you're right. Do you know what, where there's a lot of games that do not have RPG elements in them are indie roguelikes, which have no progression in them on purpose. Or if they do, they're in, like contained to one game and then they end.
Yeah. But, I mean, they're giving you that sense of progression over and over again.
Yeah,
rather
you're
than
right.
Just not having
No, I take it all back. You're totally right.
And that's, I think, part of why indie roguelikes are so popular, because like it's the progression that you enjoy. Even like a game like Dota or League of Legends or something, you know, you grind up the levels on this little character and buy them equipment every half an hour. You regrind them from zero. And it's like that, giving that progression in like this fire hose of just the grind. An old game where you can just, you know, grind the same character over and over and over again, which is pretty hilarious. There's some exceptions, like in Necrodancer, it's a roguelike where you die and there's no progression, quote unquote, but you can get some permanent power-ups in the game, so you can get as you do the levels, you get gems, and then the gems can be used to like permanently increase your health or permanently have more power-ups in the levels, which is sort of an interesting mix.
You can also do that in some cases in in like shorter DLC add-ons. I've been going back and catching up on some of the DLC that I missed, because I'm sort of gearing up to get rid of my 360 and PS3 and get a PS4. And so I wanted to go back and play the DLC on all the 360 and PS3 games that I'd sort of bookmarked. And so I just finished playing Minerva's Den, the BioShock 2 add-on. And it's basically not connected to the main story, but you power up the character in it almost as fast over the course of the like three levels of it that you play as you did in the entire main game. So it's like this really accelerated reprogression of, you know, of the entire character customization process from the main game.
No, I've had this longstanding dream of like taking that level up, like feeling, and just combining it down even more than that, even more than the League of Legends 30 minutes. I want like the 5 minute, like level zero to level 1,000 feeling. And you're like making little decisions along the way. Like, oh, do you go mage or soul warrior? Oh, do you go fire mage or ice mage? Oh, do you go inferno or, you know, like volcano? And then like having that branch off into 1,000 different level ups that feel really good all at once. I still want to make that game.
Unfortunately, if you may have to make those in real time, then you're either making random decisions or the rest of your team is yelling at you. Make a decision. What are you doing? You're just standing there. And I'm like trying to read the hover text.
Oh, there's no hover things. Text. Hover text is out.
No, it's just like, do you want to be awesome or super? I'm going to be awesome. It's going to be great.
So excited.